Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, the yield curve. By the end of this lecture, I will be able to show you how to predict the future with pretty high accuracy. And specifically, you'll see predicting the current future from where we are now, about 6 to 12 months out. Before I do that, though, just a quick look at the numbers just to have the day start off appropriately. Looking for my TA to remove the students with computers out. Where is she? Oh, well. This is, there we go. Here we are. Okay, now, sir, a bear day or a bull day? A bear day. It's not a horrible bear day, but interestingly enough, do you see that? This happened yesterday, or Monday, too. You see how we have the Dow is down the worst, and then the S&P 500, not quite as bad, and then the NASDAQ is taking a real good swat. It's kind of an odd day that whatever's going on is much more adverse to small companies than it is to larger companies, the effect is. And where is this coming from? Well, one thing is that there is quite a bit of reason to believe that the Federal Reserve is going to start jacking up interest rates, putting pressure on them, getting them up. And, of course, that's going to adversely affect business. And I'm going to talk about that briefly before we go on with the interest rate section. But we also have the continuing concern, which I was talking about in the international finance class as well, of a war breaking out in Eastern Europe, notwithstanding representations by our adversary, Russia, that they were backing down. The intel is telling us that exactly the opposite is happening. There are lots of nodes of intel data telling us that there is a lot of cyber warfare already underway, both around Europe and the Middle East and Eastern Europe, and also that apparently there are some attacks happening here in the United States right now. So that's going to cause the markets to have some pretty serious jitters. Because, I mean, it's one thing when we send you poor souls over there to die in some foreign country, but it's another thing when they start playing with our financial system and all that. That's when it gets down to being a serious issue. So that one is causing major jitters. And of course, well, not of course, I want to emphasize this. We do not like risk in finance. If we are going to face risk, we want a higher return. We expect a higher return for it. As a rule, we try to shed risk as much as we can. We'll be talking about that, especially after the spring break. We're going to get into how we eliminate risk. There are a couple of places in finance, in investments, where we actually embrace risk. If you want to take my derivatives class, you'll see where that's what we do there. But normally, we don't like risk. Risk increases. Risk actually suppresses prices, and we'll see a lot about that when we get to the chapters on stocks and bonds and what causes their prices to be what they are. But anyway, we've got risk. Risk going up suppresses prices. So we look here. Well, there you go. Crude is trying to find its way up. It's near, I believe it actually crossed 95 a barrel briefly this morning, but it wants to find 95 on its way up to 100. So we are on track for some expensive gasoline down the road. Moving along. Now, as you point out again, The prices of securities, the equities going down, which you're seeing there with the S&P 500 and the Dow indexes and the NASDAQ exchange and the Russell index, that is that money that is being coming out of those markets as investors sell their equity positions, they go somewhere. Now, you can see that there is a little bit of money going into metals there, gold and silver, not a spectacular amount, but they're going there. Now, here, yields are going down, which means that prices are going up, but that is hardly any movement at all. That's a tiny little, that's 0.7 basis point. So the yields are going down, prices are just going up a tiny bit. So the money is not going into bonds so much. Maybe a little bit in the metals. Money is coming out of equities, so where is it going? Into cash. That's where you put money when there's a lot of uncertainty. You're going to probably put it in cash and just say, let's see what happens next. So we see the investors are trying to get away from the excitement as much as they can and just put it somewhere where they can say, well, down the road we'll have a clearer picture. And that's definitely the case in Eastern Europe right now. And it will even be more the case as we see how aggressively the Fed moves on interest rates. And of course, you can see, as you can see here, London actually took a dive in the early morning over there in Great Britain, and then it kind of flopped around, and then it started trying to recover near the end of the day there. And then our day started, and things were all kinds of bad. Now, as you can see, the Nikkei had a slow, quiet rise through the day, up a nice 2.25% for the whole day. So I don't know. They seem to be okay over there. This is not their problem. This is not their fight. They don't really have any dog in the fight in Eastern Europe. So they're going to be happy with where they are. And so their markets are going to be driven more by the economics conditions of Japan itself. Let me tell you something. Like I said, I'm going to show you a way that you can predict the future, and it's actually quite accurate. I have to give you a little bit of a lead into it here. And there's a little math here today and on Friday. By the way, Friday, there is a quiz. It's an ass beater, I promise you that. So if you're going to go and bitch about it, please get ready with your script right now. It's going to be not that bad, though. I mean, it's just all those formulas that I've given you for present values, time value of money. So a calculator is going to help you a lot on that one. Anyway. Nice. Take the pain away of this day. I'm going to bring up a brief mention, and then it comes in a little more important later on today or on Friday, that a lot of times in subjects, especially like finance and economics, we'll do something in a way that is not technically actually right, but it's good enough for most purposes. And we live our lives that way. We know we should eat better, but still, that cheeseburger sure is damn good. So, and this is the true in what I show you here. And truth be told, a lot of times I won't do the technically correct way myself in my own professional work. I'll use a simpler way. Remember this thing where I said the risk-free rate is the real rate of return plus the inflation premium, and that's really the expected inflation premium. Yeah. So, I mean, if I had a real rate of, let's say, 2% and an expected inflation premium of, let's say, 3%, then I'd say that the risk-free rate is 5%. And there's nothing really wrong with that, although it's technically not exactly right. There is a phenomenon, we call it the Fisher effect, after the fellow who pointed out to all of us that, yeah, there's actually a technically more correct way to calculate the risk-free rate, or to calculate any rate that comprises several pieces. If there's any rate that is more than one piece, you technically shouldn't add them up. What you should really do is say that the risk-free rate here would be 1 plus 0.02 times 1 plus 0.03 minus 1. This takes into effect the compounding. Let me show you what I mean here. I hope I do this right. So I'm going to do 1 plus 0.02 times, close parenthesis, 1 plus 0.03 minus 1. So the actual risk-free rate is 5.06%. And you're saying, well, whoop-de-doo, fat boy, that's not that much. And you're right. Now, if these interest rates were these two rates were larger, then that Fisher effect would be more important. Here, it changes our answer by what? Maybe a tenth of a basis point, but it's not really important. There are a couple of places where we need to do it because there is a secret that can be extracted if you do it the right way. In this kind of stuff, it really doesn't matter too much whether you do it the additive or multiplicative way. Nature actually, the interest rates, percentages, are actually not really what nature works with. They work with 1 plus the rate. A growth rate of 4% is technically 1.04 for mathematical purposes. A decay rate of 3% is technically 1 minus 0.03 or 0.97%. It's not that important in most of our work. But you'll see there's a place where, like I said, we can extract something hidden in this. Now, let me take this off the board for a while here and get back out of that little arcane thing right there. This is nasty. Let's see if this erases. Yeah, that really helped a lot. Look at that. Does anyone ever wash these erasers? Anyway. Okay, now here comes the part where I talk about looking at the future. Let's do a 1 year. Now, there was a data set that was provided by the United States government, the Treasury Department, and I'd been pulling that up since there was an internet. I mean, years. I would pull up this chart. It showed the yields for different maturities, 3 month, 6 month, 9 month, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. I think there was a 7 years, a 10, 20, and 30. And this chart showed you the historical data, day by day, of the yields on these treasuries. Now remember, treasuries have no liquidity premium, no default premium. So the only thing that would be driving the yield to be different from one to the other would be the maturity premium. Typically, and it drives me crazy, I used to be able to pull this up and you'd see like this whole ocean this way and this way, day to day. And now they, for some reason, and I'm a little suspicious of why they've made it go away, it's not there anymore. So you'd have, let's say, 1.02, 1.03, 1.05, and 1.20, 1.25, 1.31, 1.40. 1.55, and these are just numbers, kind of trying to pull some out of my memory from just last semester I was using that chart. 1.80, 2.1, 1.0 and 2.035. See, the yield would be going up just because the maturity premium is going up the longer the instrument. That's a great question as the test or a quiz. As the time to maturity increases, the maturity premium increases. That's like a true or false. But as you can see, that's just a normal yield curve. It has a look sort of like this. Now, the yield curve is usually graphed as what we call a log linear, so that 3 to 6 months has the same length on the x-axis as 20 years to 30 years, just so that you don't get this really wide thing. And a normal yield curve has a nice upward slope to it. Just a gentle, as the maturity premium builds over time. That is what we would, if we looked at that on a given day, that would be a healthy yield curve. It would say that the future for at least the next year or so looked good. Year, a couple of years. Now, you don't want it to arch too hard upward like this. That would tell us that there was a changing inflation premium. Inflation was building. The expectation of inflation way down the road was more than it is right now. So if it goes up too fast, that can tell us, well, the markets are thinking that inflation is going to get kind of nasty long down the road. But then there's one that is really, really a problem. That one right there is called an inverted yield curve. An inverted yield curve. It would be what you'd see if a rate out here were lower than a rate here, or a rate here were lower than a rate here. That shouldn't happen. Every recession in U.S. history has been preceded by 6 to 9 months by an inverted yield curve. Every recession that we've ever had, an inverted yield curve happened before, about 6 to 9 months. So if you ever saw an inverted yield curve, you'd say, oh, whoa, that's not good. Now, there have been a couple of inversions that did not lead to a recession. They just led to a slowdown, a pause in the economy. So in other words, not every inverted yield curve predicted a recession, but every recession that ever happened had an inverted yield curve happen before it. Back in 2000, in 2000, I wrote my own website doing economic analysis, political analysis, social issues. And in the early part of 2008, the yield curve, these numbers were getting too darn close to each other. The 7-year and the 5-year, the 7-year and the 5-year were getting really close. But this one didn't go below this one. And I was writing about this, so about every couple of days, I was saying, the yield curve is close to inversion. If it's not going to invert, then I can't make any prediction. So day to day, I kept watching it. And it was in May that just for a few hours, the 7-year yield was just a couple of basis points below the 5-year. That's all it takes. If it happens, even just for a few hours, that's all that matters. And I wrote an important blog post, Inverted Yield Curve. We will have a recession. Now, obviously, I was going a little overboard because there have been inverted yield curves that didn't lead to a recession. But I saw there were a lot of other factors I was writing about that had been building for a couple of years. in 2005, 2006, and up to 2007 and 8 that told me there were a lot of very bad things that were going on in the U.S. economy under the surface as far as the data went. So I called a recession. And then on September 15th of 2008, all hell broke loose. We came very close to the end of the financial world as we know it. And we had a recession, a terrible, the worst recession since the Great Depression followed that in 2008, in the later months of 2008 into 2009. It was a bad one. And it was my prediction, at least in part, was based upon the fact that I saw an inverted yield curve. And that's, you just have to keep an eye on it. And so this is a way to predict the future. Now let's have a look at the yield curve right now. There are a few sites that show dynamic yield curves, what the yield curve's been doing over the past few months. And one of those, it's not a government site. Let's see if I can find it. Here it is. Oh, looky there. That's our yield curve right now. Do you see it? That thing, I am not convinced that it's inverted. It doesn't look like it's completely inverted yet. But that yield right there, the 10 and the 7, are almost the same. We are really close to an inversion. If I can see the data somewhere, for God's sake, it would be nice to see it because I can't tell. It almost looks like it has inverted. I can't tell, though. If that's an inversion, we've got a recession. We will have a recession because there are other factors that are pointing to a recession as well. And so that means that it will be nasty, probably about 4 to 6 quarters, and that'll be mean that you'll be going out there into a job market where... whoop-de-doo. Thank you, Prof. it's not a pleasant look to it right now. I mean, this is like I see some of you students the day before you get sick, and you got a green pallor to you. You're walking on all fours. No, man, I'm not sick. I'm not testing positive yet, dude. You got Rona written all over you. But what I'm trying to get at here is that I can see this one coming. This one is, it's going to invert probably either by Friday or early next week, and I'll show it to you, and then we'll just write it out here. And by the way, I am awfully damn good at predicting the economy. I've been doing it for many, many years, and I've gotten a lot of detractors over the years. Yeah, you're full of it, man. Yeah, I'm full of coffee. Let me show you something here. Here's a cool thing. You can take this out. Here, see the yield curve? This was the yield curve several months ago. I like this because you can actually see that. Now watch what's been happening as we get closer to the present. Do you see how the whole, do you see this whole curve right in here out there is rising upward? And now the front end, notice how the front end didn't want to go up, and now it's going up, it's arching, and you're seeing, there you go, it's trying to invert. It is trying to invert. It wants to invert. So that's why I'm saying, look at this, it has been heading toward an inversion for months, and boom, there we are now, sitting right on the edge. Like I said, I can't tell without the numbers themselves, but that looks like the 7 and the 10-year are the same yield right now. By tomorrow, the 7 might be above the 10. Now, the one that really was spectacular was the one in 2008. By the time we were within a month or two of the near apocalypse, it had several inversions in it. And I don't think I'd ever seen that in my life. So that I knew that was going to be a really bad one. I had no idea it was going to be as scary as it got. Unfortunately, most people don't know how scary it got, and I'll talk about that a little later in the course, how we were about 2 hours away from the collapse of the financial system in the world financial system. Wow. But anyway, this isn't anything like this. This is pretty much a normal. One thing I will tell you, do you see this steep arc up here in the front end? That's telling a story that the inflation premium is, I erased it, the inflation premium is building in the short run treasury yields. In other words, that treasury yield for anything from 3 months up to 2 or 3 years, that's got a lot of inflation expectation in it. So in other words, the markets are thinking it's going to take a while, even if the Fed starts to act right now, which they probably are, it's going to take a while to shake that inflation out. So you can expect price increases for another 12 months before they cool off and settle back down. But yeah, there you are right there. Not a pleasant looking yield curve. But now you know one of our, it's an old tool, and a lot of economists and professors, you can't trust those things. Well, I do, you know, it's, the world hasn't changed in that way. These yield curves still tell you a story. Now, and by the way, this site is called, it's stockcharts.com, and they have all kinds of kind of neat stuff that you can pull out there. If you want some economic data, it doesn't hurt to go here. They've got this nice little innovative thing with the dynamics going on, and you can download these data sets, and they're pretty user-friendly stuff. So I'm going to put that up in the scrolling marquee over on my website, isu-prof.com, so that you can see those for yourself and get, you know, if you are into that or if you've got a research paper, doesn't hurt to use this. It's a very reputable site. It's been around for a long, long, long time. Okay. Now, taking that off the table here for a little while, just to point out that we do have a very serious situation. So what I'm telling you isn't just arcane, put it in your notes so you can pass a test. It's useful for you for longer term to keep an eye on the economy in a very simple way. Now, let me take that a little bit further here. I'm going to show you something here. This is a hidden thing. It's called a forward rate. It's called a forward rate. You see this? See these yields right here? They're composite. I can look at, I better do this with one of the guys. I can look at you, sir, and I can say, there's a guy, okay? Well, actually, I could also notice, I could pull out an eyeball, put it back in, and I could pull out, put it back in, but I put them both in, hey, stereoscopic vision, sweet. I don't know how the heck I got that one out, but what I'm trying to say here is that these interest rates along here, they are composites. Like, see this two-year rate right here? It's 1.25%, but that's actually a composite of the one-year rate and a hidden rate from 1 to 2 years called the forward rate. So in other words, that 1.25, 1 plus 0.0125. Now remember, we have to do things with actual math. Squared is 1 plus 0.0120 times 1 plus a forward rate from year 1 to year 2. I'm using some kind of cheapo notation there. In other words, that 1.25 is what the market has decided is for 2 years. But that's actually two rates. It's the rate going for the first year and then another rate compounding on that one by the Fisher effect. That's why I showed you that. So you're saying, okay, well, what does that mean? Well, I could take one plus 0.0125 squared and divided by 1 plus 0.0120 and minus 1, and I could get that point, that forward rate from year one to year two. Now, you can do this with any pair of rates, but it gets a little pain in the butt. See that 3 to 5? You don't have that intermediate 4 years, so it's a little harder there to do this thing. But this will give you enough of an idea of how it works. Let me show you. So what I would do is I would say 1.01. Really? The calculator turned off. Sorry, that just annoys me for some reason. 1.0125 squared divided by 1. For God's sake. Do you see how bad I am anymore? I mean, I've been fighting these people who want to put me in a home. (1.0125 squared to the second power) divided by (1.0120 - 1). So in other words, the hidden rate, the forward 1 to 2 year hidden rate, is 1.30%. What I'm saying here is that 1.20%, 1 + 0.0120, times 1 + 0.0130 - 1 would buy me that. For some folks, this is just kind of obvious. For others, it's really a struggle. And it's so much easier to do this in Excel, just to set up an algorithm to do it. But see that forward rate? It kind of tells us a little bit of an inside story about what's going to happen in that second year. Overall, the effect of 2 years is 1.25%. But that's really 1.20% in the first year and 1.30% in the second year of the 2 years. It's like a little hidden gem in yield curves that tells us a little story. Now, one thing that's interesting here, what if we had, well, let me do an inversion right here. Suppose that we had a 1.20 on the first year, and in the second year, we had a 1.18. That would be an inversion of the yield curve. It'd be a very close inversion, but you see that'd be an inversion. Watch what happens when we look at the forward rate from that. It would be 1 + 0.120 × 1 + the forward 1 to 2 year rate was creating the effect of 1 + 0.0118 squared, 2 year compounding. Now you'll see why the yield curve inversion is scary AF. So, the forward rate, if there's an inversion, would be 1.0118 squared divided by 1.0120. -1, and then we times it by 100. Now let's see if I can do it right. 1.0118 to the second power divided by 1.0120 - 1. Times 100. So in other words, we're seeing the forward rate is actually considerably lower than the one-year rate. In that second year, interest rates, the market is actually saying in year 1 to 2, interest rates are going to really unravel. That's what an inverted yield curve actually is showing us, is that the intra-year interest rate yield is actually sliding backwards because there's so little business activity that the demand for capital is falling. That's not a good thing. That's what an inversion tells us, is that in this case, in the 1 to 2 year period, there is so little demand for capital that interest rates are falling because no one's demanding borrowed money. Just a little bit of an insight there, just a little bit. Now, let me get this awful stuff off the board here. That's enough math for one day. I'm going to show you something. There's numbers here, but it's more of an intuitive thing. Let me show you something. Projects. A, B, C, and D. 4 projects. And let's talk about the return on investment to these 4 projects. And we'll see the effect of interest rates going up. If the Federal Reserve starts to tighten the money supply, supply goes down, price of money, interest rates go up. So the first thing we're going to do is talk about these projects. And we're going to talk about different interest rate regimes, 5%, 10%, and 15%. But first, we're going to say Project A has a return on investment of 13%. Project B has a return on investment of 4%. Let's say it's 6%. Project C has a return on investment of 9%, and Project D has a return on investment of 16%. And these are costs of capital. Now, if my capital costs me 5% and I can fund a project that gives me 13%, I'm going to say absolutely, yes, I get more than I borrowed, paid for it. Now, if this project B at 6%, if I can get money at 5%, and I can make 6% on it? Absolutely. Now, let's do this one, 9%. Well, if I can get money at 5% and I can make 9% on it, sure. And D, oh yeah, 16%, 5% money, that's great. So in other words, in a cost of capital environment where the weighted average cost of capital is 5%, I'm going to take all 4 of those projects. Now let's say that the cost of capital goes up to 10%. Well, A is paying 13%, so absolutely, I'll take that one. B, well, no, I mean 6% and I have to pay 10% for it? Absolutely not. C, 9%, but I pay 10%? No, I'm not going to take C. And D, at 16%, well, yeah, I mean, it cost me only 10%? Absolutely. So by going up to 10%, I am not going to do 2 of the 4 projects. In other words, I don't hire people for 2 of those 4 projects. I don't buy the equipment for 2 of those 4 projects. Now let's take the cost of capital up to 15%. A, which was really a gem, no, because I'm going to make 13%, but it cost me 15%. No, I'm not going to do it. B, well, you suck. C, 9%? No, because it cost me 15%. The only one I'm going to take is the D. Now, it's not just this. The story behind it. By the time we get up there, do you see how as interest rates rise, we are cutting off the lower return projects. Lower return would mean that those are lower risk projects. Do you see how, as interest rates rise, companies are being backed into a corner where the only thing they can do is take on the highest risk projects? And the highest risk projects, well, spank me, those are going to be the ones that are the most likely to not work. Bankruptcies go up. So that's why when the Fed starts cranking up interest rates, that's when you start to see the effects of a recession start to kick in down the road, because companies no longer will take on a lot of the projects that they would have before. And the ones that they will take on are the Hail Marys, the ones where it's a long pass down the field and just hope someone catches the football. That's the whole point of how, and I mean, it's pretty obvious and simple when you think about it, how the mechanics work. And you can get really complicated PhD level math and all that, but it boils down to this. As interest rates go up, you're not going to take projects that pay low interest rates. And that's one of the problems, is that a lot of people think, well, I've got to make so much money on this, I'm not going to take on anything. I want to do, make a high return on whatever I do in my life. Well, that means you're going to probably get your butt kicked. Those low return projects, those are the long haulers. Those are the ones that are going to make you a fortune over a lifetime. I go back to the famous stories of some of the wealthiest families in the country and around the world. They didn't make their money off some flash-in-the-pan fad. They made their fortunes off tiny little increments of profit on each unit. A candy maker makes a piece of candy that's going to make maybe a half a cent per piece that it makes, but over a lifetime making billions and billions of those, that family trust is going to be staggering after a few generations of doing that. Hence, the Kraft family and all those ones who made simple little trinkets and toys or made little screws and nuts and bolts. They didn't make a huge amount on each one, but those low-risk projects were the ones that kept them making money for generations. But when you have this happen, new entrants are not going to, even the companies that are already out there, are not going to do those projects that are more likely to be to their benefit in the very long run. That's how it works, unfortunately. And so you see that as the interest rates rise, the reason those are good for stopping inflation, other than the fact that money is no longer being overprinted, is that they kill off the economy. They kill it. And unfortunately, there's not much you can do. Now, we would love to have it so that we can do this very slowly and we don't have to go too high before an inflation is killed off. Unfortunately, doesn't usually work that way. We keep pushing it and pushing it until it is an absolute disaster. This is what happened during the 1960s and 1970s, we saw it coming. The inflation, the overheating of the economy, it was building all those years. And every time they talked about, well, we're going to have to clamp down the money supply, they didn't. Because if they had, a recession would have happened, and then the president would have gotten kicked out of office. And so they didn't do it. And unfortunately, until 1979. And guess what? When they finally did it, it took a hell of a crank up for a long time in the interest rates. And of course, the president, who was in office at the time, he was defeated in the 1980 election because he couldn't show this stuff, because no one would have believed it. Very few people would have understood this is what we have to do now. Just like there are not going to be a lot of people who understand what the Fed is doing now. Why do we have to do this? Well, because that's the only way you're going to stop this. Next point that I should make here. I was going to show you. No, I don't think I can do that right here. Exit without saving state. Let me get this off the board here. Just one last point before I finish this whole thing up. Now, I have enough time. No, I don't. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.